Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. He served as personal secretary to Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger and then to Pope Benedict XVI until his death in 2022. The 66-year-old German archbishop is without an assignment after being told by Pope Francis to leave Rome and return home almost immediately after Benedict's death. He's the author of a new book, Who Believes Is Not Alone, My Life Beside Benedict XVI. I sat down with him recently in New York to discuss the book, Cardinal Ratzinger's repeated attempts at retirement, and that fateful decision by Pope Benedict in 2013 to step down from his role as Supreme Pontiff. Here's my exclusive interview with the man who served two popes and lived with one, Archbishop Georg Ganswein. Archbishop, thank you for coming. Thank you for sitting down for the interview. It's great to see you again. Tell me, in your new book, Who Believes Is Not Alone, you give such penetrating insight into really not only the last years of Pope Benedict, but really your entire life with him, which covers, what, more than 20 years. I want to go to something more contemporary, the Synod on Synodality, which we just saw the first phase of. Pope Benedict was around when this was announced. Did he have any insights or concerns about this particular form of the Synod of Bishops? Do you recall?
There is a very simple answer. He didn't command that. He read it, but he didn't command it. And I have not asked him. I cannot say why, but I said to myself, if he is silent about that, he will not be asked. And therefore, no question, no answer, finito. Hmm.
And that's how he really, is that how he absorbed, if you will, Pope Francis's papacy? He just sort of observed it without getting directly involved or commenting?
That's right. After his resignation, he said, I'm not more Pope, I'm the Papa Emerito. The Pope is Francis. He is the successor of Peter, actually successor, and he has the responsibility to guide the church and not me more. And all the time, all the 10 years, this was his navigation. It was his clear game, and okay.
I want to talk later about his prayer life, about the personal side of him we didn't see. But I want to take you back. You opened the book in February of 2003. Now, you were working then with Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger at the Doctrine of Faith. That's where I first met you. What happens during that coffee break in February of 2003, and why?
I came to the Doctrine of the Faith in 95. And Cardinal Ratzinger was convinced when he will ask Pope John Paul II, I am here more than 20 years. I'm an old man. I'm tired. I will resign. He has written. And he was... There was no answer, not yet, because he came 82.
Yes.
And normally a prefect is nominated for 5 years, another 5 years, another 5 years, another 5 years, 20 years. And he said he was convinced John Paul II will, this time, he will accept. Mm-hmm. Okay, that.
Because he had tried to resign multiple times. He told me that in 2003.
Yes, that's right.
And so
there are the letters from him to the Pope and from the Pope to him, the answers. And then he said in 2002, the first time, I will write another time. And then he must say, okay, I accept. And he was convinced that he will be at most 3-4 months a prefect. Mm. But his former secretary, became undersecretary of another congregation.
Joseph Clemens.
Yes. And I need a private secretary, and we two, she said, me, the cardinal, and me, he spoken in Italian, Don Giorgio, mm-hmm. we will be, I don't know the precise word in English, in Italian it's provisorio.
Provisional.
He is a provisional, and me.
Uh-huh. Because he thought he was going to retire.
Yes, and then I retire, and he will go back to the old rule. Mm-hmm. 3 months. There are 20 years, because there was no answer from Pope John Paul II, month by month. And in April 2005, Pope John Paul died. The conclave, and from the Cardinal Ratzinger, what went out? Benedict XVI.
And you got drafted into
yes,
becoming that was the Pope's secretary.
Yeah, that was secretary. The difference was not more living in the Holy Office and working, but in the Apostolic Palace. Mm-hmm. That's all. And that was in February 2003. He was convinced the other will come. But the other.
Well, you write in the book that this retirement, and I've seen this not only in my interview, throughout his life, retirement, this quest for retirement. He wanted to retire to Bavaria with his brother. They were going to live in a little chalet and write and play music together. He sort of had this vision in his head. But you say in the book, it was a constant theme that was always out of reach. Why do you think he wanted to retire so desperately?
No, I think, and I've seen, he was 78 years. 78.
Yeah.
So 77, and his birthday is April 16.
Yeah.
And April 19, he was elected Pope, 3 days after his birthday.
Yeah.
Now, one thing for him was very, very important, to write or to finish a book about Jesus Christ, like a witness about his personal, scientific life, about a priest, about a bishop, and also cardinal, with all the experiences, the personal experiences. And therefore, he... okay, that's my future, and I have time, and I will finish that book. And I remember very well then, in April he was elected, and then above 2 or 3 months later, because in that time, that 3 months, he didn't speak about the book. No word. Because he was convinced it's over.
He won't be able to do it.
It's not more possible. Mm-hmm. Being a pope, I have to do others. And in June, I asked me, can you make a copy of this article? Of course, why not? Mm-hmm. And then, well, for me, it was the first time that desire to continue was reborn.
And that became the Jesus of Nazareth. Tell me about the historic resignation. Okay, here we are, February 2013. It shocked the world. But you knew about this, Archbishop. You had indications of this much earlier. How did you come to know that Pope Benedict intended to resign? And in the book you indicate that you tried to talk him out of it.
Yes, how? We've been... It was September 2012. Normally the Pope or the Popes have been from the 1st of July or after John Paul II, he liked to go first in the mountain and then till October, Castel Gandolfo. Normally August was a free month. Only the general audiences and the Angelus Domini.
Right. On Sundays.
Okay, Sundays. Mm-hmm. I've seen, it was in March and April, he went to Mexico and to Cuba. He went back, was very tired, very, very, very tired. And then he slept step by step till July. And in these days, from July to August, he was like exhausted. Hmm. Because in these days, or in these days, he finished the third, the small Jesus from Nazareth. And I thought he will all the strength, all what are in reserve, mm-hmm. put down yeah. and put in.
He expanded himself yes, writing that yes. book.
And then in September, he said to me, normally I was by him about 11 o'clock with the correspondence, mm-hmm. and then in the afternoon another time, two times a day. And he said to me, this evening came earlier. Please come earlier. Okay. Okay. And normally he sit down. He was sitting on the chair, on the table, and I was up the and that no, take also you a chair. The first time I 8 years. I won't. Okay. And then I have to tell you something. I'm old. I have no more strength. I have reflected, I have prayed, I have struggled with myself. And I have come to the conviction, not only that I have to resign from papacy. By love of Jesus and the church. And I said, Holy Father, it's impossible. No, that's impossible. Far away. You can delegate this. Oh, no, I've spoken like a fighter about 5 minutes. He was still silent. And then he said to me, excuse me, I have not said something to discuss. It's not more necessary. I have told you my decision. Mm. Oh, it was that, in that moment I was, I do not know, but it was heavy.
Yeah.
And that was the first, and then he thought, you will be one of the three persons who knows that. And please, you have now be under the pontifical secret.
Wow.
That was the first time a month ago.
But did he consider the consequences of that? Or I've read some reports where he assumed his protege, Angelo Scola, was going to succeed him, or someone like him. Was that the thinking?
I fear that was the thinking. Someone will come and to convince it's not possible, like me. Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't hear it.
No. Mm. I cannot say why, but he said no. It's. I cannot more. And I think, and that. All the years after, when he was a resigned pope or pope emeritus, he never had a doubt that was the right decision.
Was it? You've seen all the reportage. It was Vatican leaks. It was
no. Yes, yeah.
you don't. That has
no. That is. He said sometimes to me, there is no reason in all the things that went wrong, Vatican leaks or homosexual. Groups or there. Sometimes there was it was not real, and in another way, he said, "I can go now because there is no danger of the church. If there is a wolf coming, and the shepherd cannot go, but if there is no wolf, there is no danger. I can, and the Lord will." preserve, and the Lord will guide his church with another successor of Peter. Of Peter.
Did he regret it?
Never.
How do you see those 10 years? And how, I mean, I know he was praying. I know he was writing. I know he was suffering. Tell me about that time.
The first 2 months, he was exhausted. He was very tired. He has spoken very, very little. And then, after the comeback to Rome, after May, 2nd May, I remember very well, more and more the strength came back. And there was, he is a very systematic man.
No? Yes.
Holy Mass, bravery, then the breakfast, rest, then bravery, then correspondence, lecture, music, bravery, and then lunch. After lunch, a small walk. They had a very
gardens.
Gardens. No. After lunch, we have been on our terrace in the monastery, and rest. And then, in the afternoon, the first was the bravery, and then we went out to pray the rosary. Back correspondence, and there are in the first year. At the end of the morning and in the late afternoon, there have been guests. Many, many asked.
Yeah.
Oh. And then dinner, small dinner, and then he retired. And that's many, many years. Of course, he did not write. He answered the correspondence.
Uh-huh.
But there were a few occasions where he was asked to say something,
right,
to write something, and also to help something.
Hmm.
And normally, he could not say no.
Hmm.
And he would not say no.
I want to talk about Summorum Pontificum, which is one of the hallmarks of Benedict's legacy. Of course, his focus was always on the reform of the liturgy. That was always his life's work. And whether it was the translations in the Novus Ordo around the world or permitting greater freedom for the old Latin rite. And I'll read from Summorum Pontificum. He said it was always clear, or you write this, it was always clear in Ratzinger's mind that there was only one rite, subsisting in the coexistence
yes.
of an ordinary and extraordinary form. The one intention of his motu proprio was to repair the gaping wound that had formed over time, be it voluntary or involuntary. Now, what were the Pope's thoughts after he saw that motu proprio play out? Was he pleased with the way it was received at the time?
In that time, Pope Benedict has been very weak. Physically. And normally, he asked me to read something he would read, and he was there on the paper, on the table, and I'm here, and I have read from the Osservatore Romano the text, because the only text was published in that time in the Osservatore Romano. I read and read. There was the motu proprio and also the letter of Pope Francis.
You're talking about Custodes.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah, yeah.
The motu proprio. So I was talking about his motu proprio and how it was received,
oh.
how Benedict was received.
Oh, no.
But now you're talking about when Pope Francis
yes.
basically clamped down
yes,
on
yes.
the Latin rite
okay.
and demolished that motu proprio.
Look, about his motu proprio, for mm-hmm. Benedict. No?
Yeah.
Was allowed to have a
You're right. It was a liberalization of the old rite.
Because what that two intentions. The first, that the liturgy is the way to connect with God. And it's impossible that the liturgy, that was the liturgy for 500 years, many saints and will be forbidden, or is not more allowed. And the first step in that direction has made John Paul II. Yeah?
Yes.
That's the first.
With Ecclesia Dei, where they allowed it in certain instances with the permission of the bishop.
In the year after, Cardinal Ratzinger and also Pope Benedict have seen that's good, but it's too... There are many, not I do not know of many, but there are bishops that did not agree, and that's not good. And therefore he gave more liberty.
Mm-hmm. And let the priests decide whether they wanted to celebrate the old rite or
and
not.
And the second was, liturgy is so important that it cannot be forbidden by means or by motives or by reasons that are not clear. Mm. And therefore he said, I will open, and that must lead to the peace in the church regarding liturgy, and also including then Pius XII.
Right. Yeah. And it worked.
It worked.
It brought peace.
Yes.
There was no problem or schism yet. In his retirement, in the book you relate, you sit at the table, you pick up L'Osservatore Romano, you read Pope Francis's motu proprio, which basically overrules Benedict and shuts down the Latin Rite. What was his reaction? What did he say to you?
Pope Benedict had never commanded decisions or motu proprio from Pope Francis. That was very intelligent. I've written also, it was my impression, Pope Benedict, hearing what I was reading, his heart was very, very triste. And then when I finished, I said, Holy Father, can I ask you a question? Please. I do not understand that motu proprio, because the liberty you have gave with your motu proprio years ago have brought peace in the liturgy and in the church. And I fear this motu proprio will cause many, many problems. The answer was, I hope God will help us. He didn't commentate the motu proprio because he wouldn't comment decisions.
But he did comment when Pope Francis submitted an interview to him that he had given in Italian.
Oh, yeah, that's what
years
ago.
Tell us about that.
I think it was 2014. And Pope Francis have given an interview. Ask him to give some impressions or a comment.
Right.
And I remember very well, because Pope Francis have given that to me to bring to Benedict, and Benedict the same way, okay. And he did it. But it's the only I think it was the only time Pope Francis has asked Pope Benedict to comment or to give a comment to that he said.
And he particularly commented on Pope Francis's mentions of homosexuality, abortion, the way it was formulated. He took issue with the formulation.
Pope Francis asked him to comment. And following, being obedient.
Yeah. He did so.
He did, though. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Tell me about I see it in your eyes now. It had to be intensely difficult for you, because here you are, serving not only as prefect of the papal household under Pope Francis, the successor of this man you've served all these years, but you're living and continue to serve as the secretary of Pope Benedict. You were caught between these two men every day of your life. That could not have been an easy place to be.
You are right. Mm-hmm. It wasn't easy, but I haven't never thought, or I have never thought that once this situation will come, the situation was there. There was no manual to see what I have to do then, what I have to do there. I would not say I was living in two worlds, but there were very different worlds.
Yeah, and very different men.
Of course, and although a different way, a different manner to govern the church, mm-hmm. to lead the church. I have done it. I've done what I was convinced you have to do that. I was loyal. I am loyal to the Pope, of course. No? And the same thing I've done regarding Pope Benedict as a Pope Emeritus. Mm-hmm. It was not easy. I had a good spiritual director. Otherwise, I think it would be impossible to survive or to live in a good, also in a good situation by heart, a good situation in my spiritual life. Mm-hmm. No? Mm-hmm. Because also myself, I'm a human being.
Give us a sense of the personalities and the way in which each of these men conducted their papacy. Contrast them, if you will. I know Pope Benedict was so regimented, you said earlier, systematic in his day. And I saw that every time I was with him. It was, oh, time to go. Have to do this. We have to pray. You know, he would cut things off because he was on a schedule. Contrast that with Pope Francis's leadership style and personal style.
That's a question I will answer with a phrase from Pope Benedict. He said, the most important thing a Pope has to do is to witness the faith, to be a good pastor, to love Christ and his church. And every Pope, seeing that four very important points, has to do that with his personality, mm-hmm. with his past, with his biography.
Mm-hmm. In 2003, Cardinal Ratzinger told me something about, I asked him, is there a de facto schism in the church? Now, this is back in 2003. He said these words, and to me, they're almost prophetic.
I would say this is a permanent problem of pastoral, to help that all people can really share the faith of the church authentically. So I think the first point is a good catechesis, that in the preparation to the faith, in the education to the faith. The other point is also the predication, that in homilies we can really year for year learn what is the faith, not only some or always the same ideas. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very real danger that in the homilies priests and also bishops could repeat essentially their preferred ideas and not mm-hmm. present the completeness of the faith.
So, given those words and what we're seeing now, your thoughts on what he said there, and do you think we're in the middle of a de facto schism, where there are people who claim to be Catholic, but really aren't, or don't wish to be, deep down?
There's a Latin phrase, de internis non judicat praetor. It means what a man really thinks, feels, you cannot see from outside. That is all for all priests. And the priest is not the preaching to preach his own ideas, but the gospel. Catechesis, homilies, that are the two, and the admission, administration of the sacrament, that's the three canals for be or to be a good shepherd. And a priest is not employed by a party, or he is the first witness also of that what he's preaching. Mm-hmm. If I do not believe in that what I preach, people feel that.
Yeah. I want to ask you just before we conclude. There was a story that went out, I remember this so distinctively, as I was on CNN at the time, when Pope Francis moved into the Santa Marta House, which is sort of the hotel, the newest establishment in Vatican City. Many were saying, look how humble Pope Francis is compared to that Pope Benedict who lived in the Apostolic Palace, the grandeur of the Apostolic Palace. Can you write that narrative, if you will? I hated watching them try to play one pope against the other, particularly because I'd been in that room. Tell us how Pope Benedict lived and what living in the Apostolic Palace really looked like from someone who lived there.
The Apostolic Palace is a Renaissance building of the 15th century.
Yeah.
Living there, on the third floor, it's not a luxury.
Yeah.
It's not. It's true that there are great rooms.
Yes. Beautiful hallways. The most spectacular hallways.
Yes.
But the rooms.
Oh, no.
They're like this.
No, it's yeah. nothing
very
special.
Spirit. Yeah.
But it seems that not living more in that palace or in that place, but in another place, built up in 1996, 97,
mm-hmm.
although with the technical and all the nice
amenities.
Things, of course. You cannot compare it that. And that it's not, who knows Pope Benedict or Paul the VI or John Paul II? There was nothing special in that palace. Nothing special.
Not in their apartment.
No.
I mean, there were little single bed. I mean, the bed, I remember seeing John
yes.
Paul's little single bed.
Yeah, the same for Benedict.
Oh, he kept the same setup.
Of course.
Yeah, this was not luxurious at all.
No.
And it's kind of drafty in the winter.
Oh.
I mean, I remember seeing him he looked like an Indian chief with a, blanket over his shoulder.
But the narrative was born, and therefore it's once about 2 months later, after the election of Pope, or 3 months, there was an audience with a school from Napoli, from Naples, and one girl has asked Pope Francis, why did you change your home? Why not the Apostolic Palace? Why Santa Marta? And then he said, my dear, there is more a psychological reason. And the first time he said, it's not because it's luxury or it's for the rich, and no. Mm-hmm. But it was too late. They changed the narrative.
Mm. Interesting.
But it's for me, that's the Pope is a man. The Pope has his personality.
Mm-hmm.
And then the papacy. And the papacy has also his forms developed about many centuries.
Yeah.
And became a pope means also to get down under that papacy. There is no private life more.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's for Benedict the most What was very heavy was to have no more private life.
Hmm.
Yeah. And that's a prize. That's a prize.
Yes.
Being prize being a pope.
Hmm. What do you want people to take away from Who Believes Is Not Alone?
My only intention was to distract, if it's possible, the false narratives about Josef Ratzinger, Cardinal Ratzinger, and Pope Benedict. One. Second, to correct many, many, many images of a man who was more shy, more humble, than a prepotent or a political man, mm-hmm. but I was a very intelligent man. The intelligence and also the faith, the deepness of his faith, the clearness of his faith, and also the faith is really one of the most important things to have joy in the life, to connect with God, and to open the life for the eternal life.
What did you learn from him in those last days, in that last period? I mean, when you're with someone, particularly someone with a deep faith life, when you see them at the end of their life, going through the struggles that we all will go through,
yeah.
What did you learn from him? What did you take from that?
Two things. The first thing, he lived. And he lived that also in the last month and weeks and days, getting more and more down,
weak.
The second, there is no reason to not remain a faithful Catholic, because it's the direct way to the heaven.
What a great way to end the interview. Thank you.
Thank you.
Who Believes Is Not Alone, My Life Beside Benedict XVI by Archbishop Georg Ganswein is available now at bookstores everywhere and online, including the EWTN catalog. And there's a new film I have to tell you about. It's called Arthur the King. It is a family film. Everybody can go see it. And it stars Mark Wahlberg and a particular dog.
This story is one that I connected with immediately. It follows the incredible true story of an adventure racer and a stray dog named Arthur. If there's one thing I've learned, it's that God can work in mysterious ways, and he can put people or even a dog in your path when you least expect it and change your life completely, just as Arthur did in the story. Thank you for your support so we can continue to make inspirational movies like this one. Please watch Arthur the King only in theaters March 15th. God bless.
We all know anything can happen out there. Sometimes we feel lost. We push and we suffer. We keep going. That makes all the difference.
Hey,
what happened to you, boy? You don't look so good.
Uh-huh.
Meatball? Look, somebody likes my meatballs. Hey, Paw Patrol, we got a race to win.
Just remember, Michael, this race doesn't define you.
I raced for 19 years. This is my last chance to win.
3, 2,
as a young boy living in the city, all I did was run, 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 run.
Over the next 10 days, these athletes will cross 400 miles climbing, biking, and kayaking.
That dot is daddy.
Go, daddy, dot.
Let's talk again to meatballs. 3 days, 200 miles ago. Leave the stupid dog and let's go. Come on. Move, dumb dog. What is it, boy?
Oh.
Oh, God.
Can't believe I almost walked right off that cliff.
Extra meatballs for you, my friend. He's hurting. What do you think he went through before he met us?
Whatever it wasn't good.
How the hell did he get all the way from here to there while we were on bikes and zip lines and running and climbing?
He must have wings we don't know about.
Oh boy!
You know I'm back like I never left.
You want to start to embrace the buckets of pain?
I need a bigger bucket.
Team Broad Rail has traveled over 200 miles, and they found a companion.
Daddy has a dog?
What have you done?
I think you found your new partner in suffering, Michael.
Yeah.
He's the king.
I think we should call him Arthur.
Arthur the King.
How's he doing?
He's been through so much.
This dog needs a vet.
I don't want you to hurt anymore.
He's a fighter.
Just like you. I feel
glorious. Ah, famous dog. Looks even worse than the rest of you. Maybe you all deserve each other.
Always underestimated, aren't we, buddy?
This isn't the route on the map.
It's okay. Just follow Arthur.
Lead the way, King.
I've never seen anything like this.
Everybody knows about it.
Guess what? I'm not a dog person.
Arthur the King hits theaters March 15th everywhere. Go see it. This is so worth your time.
New Jersey-based Goya Foods has grown to become the largest family-owned food company in the United States, catering to the Hispanic community and beyond all across the globe. Robert Unanue is the president and CEO of Goya. I sat down with him recently at their massive processing and distribution center outside of Houston. We talked about faith, family, and his latest passion, Goya's new initiative to combat child trafficking. Here's part one of my interview with Bob Unanue. Bob, tell me about the founding of Goya and your grandfather, Prudencio, and what happened.
Yes, my grandfather, born in 1886, leaves Spain at 18 years old in 1904 on a steamship bound for Puerto Rico on his own, you know, looking for new horizons, a way to make a living. In those times, much of Europe was under economic stress. A lot of Europeans left for South America, the Caribbean. A lot of Spaniards went to Cuba. And so he ended up in Puerto Rico and worked doing many things. Met his wife there, my grandmother. My grandfather was from Burgos, which is near the Basque region, and Unanue is a Basque name. My grandmother was from Galicia. This is on my father's side.
Yeah.
My mother's side were Irish. So he does many things in Puerto Rico. He gets married, and then he moves to New York to study. He studied in Albany. He starts working in New York, in Manhattan. He's on Duane Street, Duane Reade.
Yeah. In Tribeca is really where he starts the business.
Yes. And he's importing products. But what happens in 1936? He's importing products from Spain for the Spanish community in the U.S. Mm-hmm. The Hispanic community in the U.S. at this time is small, Mexican, but in New York, a small Spanish community. But 1936 brings on the Spanish Civil War, and products from Spain dry up. So a broker offers him 500 cases of sardines from Morocco with the Goya name on it. He liked the name. It was short, easy to pronounce. Sardines go with the Spaniards. He brought in the cases. He sold them. And he goes to the broker, Joe Calderon. He says, hey, you know, Joe, I'd like to buy that brand. He goes, it's your brand. He says, well, let's make it official. Made it official for a dollar. But a brand is really a reputation. And so my grandfather, I believe, is one of the pioneers of marketing. And so he used the Goya name, and he came up with the slogan, if it's Goya, it's got to be good. He created our own ad agency, so we would go out, create commercials, and buy commercials with agency discount and all that. But as time went on, from 36 to the Spanish community, after World War II, the Puerto Rican community came in a big way. We've basically grown. All these great countries where people come from, all these great cuisines. So what we've done is first of all, we work with the communities. We've been part of the community. When you're displaced, you're more Colombian when you're in this country than in Colombia, because you hang on to your roots.
Yeah.
And there's actually three things people hang on to as immigrants: language, food, and music. So, you know, you got Mark Anthony, you got yourself. And so those traditions are hung on to very much, and we become part of that community. We embrace it.
Is that really the secret, that you tailor the product to specific groups, really small communities?
You have to be authentic. And quality. If it's good, it has to be good. That's quality. But you also have to be authentic, because there was a gentleman that worked for us, and he said Latinos, and a big part of our business is beans.
Yeah.
He says, as Latinos, we're united by language, but we're separated by the bean.
The scale of the operation at Goya is staggering. And here in the Houston production facility, beans are king. Millions of pounds of beans are stored in bags, stacked nearly to the rafters in this massive freezer. The Houston operation allows Goya to process their beans twice as fast as most other plants. Goya sells over 40 different varieties. Beans are soaked in giant vats. The cans travel in rows through a giant hydrostatic cooker. Yes, the beans are cooked inside the can.
We bring in beans from all around the country. Most of them come from the U.S.
Yeah.
There's a bean belt across the country. We also bring in specialty beans from around the world, Central America, South America, and Mexico.
So they're processing them here. I mean, you're bleaching them.
We're bringing in dry beans. And we're both basically going to soak them, rehydrate them, because they're grown in the field.
Everybody has their favorite bean. To me, it's a pink bean, and if I'm Puerto Rican. But it's also different nomenclatures, habichuelas, porotos, caraotas, frijoles. So if you speak to a market and you're speaking, even though you're speaking Spanish, the nomenclature changes. And if you're not authentic, you're rejected. So we immerse ourselves in our community. We call ourselves La Gran Familia Goya, the Great Goya Family. And to us, it's not just the Goya family, but it's the Latino community, and now the whole, you know, U.S. community and around the world that is a family.
Okay. In the 1970s, I want to take you back a little bit.
Okay.
As a young man, you go to Seville, where your family lives in Spain for a time, and you're there working in the olive oil part of Goya. Mm-hmm. What did you do there, and what did you learn during that time?
Well, actually, in 1964, my dad brought me into to work in Brooklyn. We moved from Manhattan to Brooklyn. Oh. We also had a factory in Puerto Rico. But in 64, I worked the production line for a week, and packing olives and olive oil, we packed it. We brought in the olives in barrels, and the peppers and the capers and the olive oil, and we packed it in Brooklyn, as we had done on Duane Street. So I worked a 40-hour week. I got $20. That's like 50 cents an hour, but I still have that $20. But so that instilled in me the work ethic, and also working with other people. Now, fast forward 1972, I graduate from high school, and I go through a year of college up in Massachusetts, Augustinian School, and this is also around the time Roe v. Wade. So my father, who was very strong in his convictions, he did not want to pay his taxes for abortion, and he decided, I'm going to leave this. Six children.
Wow.
At the time, I was. We're girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy. I'm the first boy. He decided we're going to go to Spain, and he convinced his brothers, who had three brothers, and his father, my grandfather founded the company, that he was going to take our production of olives and olive oil to Spain, pack it there, and then ship it finished goods.
Mm.
So we went over there.
Did it work?
You know, he hit a lot of obstacles. Spain, you couldn't. You had to be a Spanish citizen. Mm-hmm. Actually, his mother had signed him up in the book of family book, and he became a citizen. And you know, hurdled a lot of obstacles, and I helped him building that. at the same time with learning the language. In Seville at that time, I had 3 years of high school Spanish, but was useless. But in Seville, you had two options. You could either speak Spanish or you could speak Spanish. Those were your... And
that's good. Works
you're
out.
Immersed. Uh-huh. And so being over there, again, working with my father, this is 73.
Yeah.
He spent a year in a hospital from 75 to 6. He died on March 23rd, 1976, 5 days after my grandfather. But we were over there. It was such an incredible experience because my father was so strong in his convictions about abortion, about life. And, and luckily his brothers and father said, okay, yeah, go over there and build that. And that's what he did.
Let's talk a little about convictions. You mentioned your father's convictions.
Right.
How has your Catholic faith guided you as you've taken responsibility over this food empire, really, that your grandfather and your father was such a part of?
Yes, well, I went through the whole grammar school, high school, college in the Catholic faith and Catholic education. My father wanted to be a priest, and he wanted many children. But he got sick, but he instilled in us our faith, and my mother also, of course. To my sister, to each of us, he had a different message. To my sister, Mary, he said, what's your goal in life? And she said, well, I want to be a nurse. And she did become a nurse. No, what's your goal in life? I want to be a nurse. No, your goal in life is salvation. And to me, and he was telling me this at the end also, said, Bob, stay close to the sacraments, reconciliation and then taking communion, the importance of the body of Christ in the Holy Eucharist, the confession, putting yourself in the state of grace before you receive. So those kinds of things, but really my father's example and lessons to us was a gift to us. Because he left us very young.
That sacramental aspect I see in everything Goya does. You're really feeding the world. You're feeding the larger family in some ways, which is almost a sacramental act. Does that ever play in your mind as a CEO, as you make decisions? I mean, you're dealing with 26 facilities, Houston and Puerto Rico and the Dominican Republic, and I mean, how do you marshal something this size?
Well, you know, growing up in the business, it kind of grows on you. Luckily, we surrounded ourselves with incredible people. That the technology today, you know, we run very efficiently. But growing up in the business has really helped. And my father told me a lesson, another lesson early on. He said, never look up at anyone, never look down at anyone. Look at them straight in the eye. So working shoulder to shoulder with people over and respect. You know, we're called to love, but we need to respect. And, you know, that's another story with the Holy Spirit. But, you know, the Holy Spirit gave the disciples the courage. But we start all of our... gatherings. We gather a couple times a year, the different employee groups, family groups, sales, and here in many different locations. But we always start with a prayer. And we give thanks to God for what we have. I mean, our success has been incredible. And we've been, in a way, many times protected by the Holy Spirit. And like you said, grace begins when you start make the step.
Yeah, Mother Angelica Duane. Yes. You take the first step, and grace comes as your step.
Yes.
And I think that's true. And you've seen that, I mean, throughout your life. I read in a Hispanic Entrepreneur magazine, they described you as a servant leader. Does that characterize you? Do you see yourself that way?
You know, I think we're all called, and it's really come to life over the last couple years with the political situation. I was told by one person once who said God spoke to them that the U.S. Is not ready yet. We have to suffer. And I think, in a way, the way things are today, we have to, kind of hit bottom. We're hitting bottom and turn around. But when you're called, if you don't respond, then, you know, that's not a good thing. There's an obligation to answer the call.
I've read stories and talked to employees of yours where, you know, you bring donuts to them in the morning or you drop in on things. I mean, you're close to the workers in the 4,000 employees of this company. You're not remotely, like, hiding out.
No, I can't be undercover boss. And, you know, we go to funerals and we celebrate the happy times, the births and the sad times because we're a family. And, again, it's... That extrapolates into the whole the country and the communities in which you're in. Then you become part of that.
You can find out about the amazing work of Goya Cares, Babunawe's initiative to battle child trafficking and promote children's mental health awareness at goyacares.com. Meanwhile, Cardinal Raymond Burke is calling on Catholics, especially those in the Americas, to join him in a spiritual renewal, a novena with a very special purpose. Cardinal Burke is leading a novena culminating in an act of consecration on December 12th. Listen.
This March, I am beginning a 9-month novena imploring the intercession of Our Lady of Guadalupe against the pressing crises of our age. This novena will culminate in a consecration to Our Lady of Guadalupe on her feast day in December. I ask you, please, to join me in this urgent return to Our Lady.
More information on the novena can be found at novena.cardinalburke.com. That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.